BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of The World at One from BBC Radio 4. Hello and welcome to The World at One with me, Sarah Montague. Today, as Britain goes to the polls, we're politics free. President Trump tweets, "So ridiculous. Greta must work on her anger management problem, then go to a good old-fashioned movie with a friend. Chill, Greta, chill." The American president criticises Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old behind Climate Strike Fridays. Sir Paul McCartney, who launched Meat Free Mondays a decade ago, praises students like her for taking action.
They could be like, "Oh no, let's Trump. Let's go crazy. It's a hoax." They could be saying that. Well, luckily they're not. They're way too sensible. So I like that they're pushing older people into things.
We have an exclusive interview with Sir Paul where he discusses global warming, Glastonbury and Christmas songs. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. He's not a fan of much Christmas music, so he made his own secret album just for the family.
So I'm afraid Dad's Christmas carol record comes on.
You're joking.
Yeah. Silent night now.
And 200 starlings drop dead in Anglesey. We'll hear the latest on the investigation into what killed them.
We're keeping an open mind at the moment. So we're doing the toxicology tests in case. And we're doing post-mortem tests to see whether that identifies the cause of death.
The BBC News is read by Luke Tuddenham.
The leaders of the main political parties have voted in the third general election in under 5 years. More than 3,000 candidates are contesting 650 seats across England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Our political correspondent David Cornock reports.
The polls have been open since 7 o'clock, with voters marking their ballot papers in polling stations converted from parish halls, pubs, primary schools and even a hair salon. The party leaders were swift to cast their votes in the first general election to be held in December for almost 100 years. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, voted in central London, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, in north London. Both the Lib Dems, Jo Swinson, and the SNP's Nicola Sturgeon cast their votes in Glasgow. The Brexit Party leader, Nigel Farage, voted by post. The polls close at 10 o'clock, with the first results expected before midnight. The newly elected MPs are expected at Westminster next Tuesday.
A polling station has had to be moved in Motherwell after a suspicious device was found in the early hours of this morning. Officers were called to the ground floor of a block of flats close to where people were due to vote. A controlled explosion was carried out, but police said the device was not viable. A 48-year-old man has been arrested. Russia has announced the expulsion of two German diplomats in retaliation for Berlin ordering two of its officials to leave the country last week. Germany ejected them over what it said was Moscow's refusal to engage with the investigation into the murder of a former Chechen commander in Berlin. Here's our Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg.
The Russian Foreign Ministry said it was expelling two German diplomats. They have 7 days to leave the country. This follows Germany's decision to expel two Russian diplomats over Moscow's refusal to cooperate in a murder investigation. Back in August, Zelimkhan Khangoshvili, a former Chechen rebel commander who'd been living in exile in Germany, was shot dead in a Berlin park. German prosecutors suspect the involvement of the Russian state. This week, President Putin said Mr. Khangoshvili had been a cruel and bloodthirsty person, but Moscow denies any connection to the killing.
The Gambia's legal team, which is presenting a case I think we'll come back to that story a bit later if we may. The Court of Appeal has been told that a woman who spent £16 million in Harrods and faces losing her London mansion to the National Crime Agency is the victim of a most draconian and intrusive power. Zamina Hajiva, the wife of a banker jailed for stealing millions in their native Azerbaijan, is fighting to overturn the UK's first unexplained wealth order. From the court, here's our Home Affairs correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
Zamira Hajieva owns both a £15 million Knightsbridge home and an entire Berkshire golf course, but she stands to lose both if she can't reveal to the National Crime Agency the source of her unknown wealth. Today, her lawyer James Lewis QC told the Lord Chief Justice that his client had been unlawfully targeted by the NCA He said the proof required to overturn the agency's demand for an explanation was unjust because Mrs. Hadjieva's husband, serving a 14-year sentence for embezzlement, couldn't come to London to defend himself. That meant his wife was subject to the most draconian power possible. The NCA is fighting the appeal, and in papers disclosed today, it revealed that the banker's London-based daughter attempted to sell jewellery worth £400,000 after the unexplained wealth order was imposed last year.
The Gambia's legal team, which is presenting a case accusing Myanmar of the genocide of its Rohingya Muslim minority, says the country can't be trusted to hold its soldiers accountable. Yesterday, the Burmese leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, defended Myanmar's military over a security crackdown 2 years ago that forced 700,000 Rohingyas to flee across the border into Bangladesh. From the International Court of Justice at The Hague, here's Anna Holligan.
With flowers adorning her hair, Aung San Suu Kyi listened as the allegations of inhuman acts were outlined by lawyers for the Gambia. They said the situation in Rakhine State bore all the hallmarks of genocide, firing squads, mass gang rapes. And the fact that 600,000 Rohingya remain in the region meant judges must act by agreeing to a request for emergency measures to protect them. Aung San Suu Kyi has argued it's actually a complex internal conflict. And while she conceded that individual soldiers may have gone rogue, they were being dealt with domestically with courts martial, which meant two things. There was no state-sponsored effort to erase the Rohingya, no genocide. And any action from an international court was unnecessary and would risk aggravating the sensitive state of Rakhine.
Sir Paul McCartney has revealed he's secretly recorded an album of Christmas carols. In an interview for this programme, he says he plays the instrumental recordings to his family every year. So, unlike previous festive songs he's recorded, fans shouldn't hold out any hope of hearing them, as our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson explains.
Paul McCartney's 1979 Christmas single was never exactly a critic's favourite, but he dislikes other people's festive albums so much, he took unusual measures to solve the problem of what background music to play on Christmas Day.
I actually went into my studio over a couple of years. I made one, but it's just for the family. I'm afraid Dad's Christmas Carol record comes on. It just gets brought out each year.
He says the album will never be released, so this tiny demonstration is the closest those of us who don't spend Christmas Day with Paul McCartney will ever get to hearing it.
Yeah.
Colin Patterson reporting, and we'll hear the full interview that I did with Sir Paul McCartney just in a few minutes' time. But let's kick off in this politics-free programme. Politics-free because we are required by law not to talk about politics until the polls close at 10 o'clock tonight. So let's turn to other matters. And a group of at least 50 scientists are calling on governments to set a date within the next decade for peak meat. In a letter published by Lancet Planetary Health, they argue that countries have to reduce meat and dairy consumption if they're to tackle climate change. It's not just because cattle and sheep release methane from both ends, but also because intensively reared animals eat lots of grain, and that needs lots of land, which could otherwise be returned to natural forest. Governments meeting at the UN climate conference in Madrid are considering what next steps are needed. And this letter calls on them to set limits on livestock as part of their climate promises and to set a date beyond which livestock production would not increase. 10 years ago, Sir Paul McCartney set up Meat Free Monday, a campaign to encourage people not to eat meat on one day of the week. They now reckon up to 5,000 schools in the UK have meat-free Mondays. We'll hear from him, as I say, in a moment. First, though, his call is supported by, among others, this celebrity chef, Prue Leith. She's the latest person urging schools to eat less meat. And our reporter, Charlotte Baker, went along to meet her and visited a school in Oxford that's taken up the challenge.
I've spent such a lot of time worrying about school food because I used to chair the School Food Trust, and so I really know that the average school lunch is unhealthy. And to be honest, vegetarian food can be every bit as delicious as carnivore's diet. It is definitely better for the planet. I have to say I'm a carnivore, and so I'm not going to go all vegetarian, but I do try to eat much less meat than I did. It's definitely good for your health. We all need to eat far more veg. And the best thing for school caterers is it's much, much cheaper.
parents may not be entirely thrilled at the idea of schools making choices for them. How would you engage with parents who are less than convinced about this and probably say, hang on a sec, this would be too much state interference in what I do with my child?
Yes, it's a nanny state argument. Well, I sort of sympathise with that. And in a sense, that's what I felt once upon a time. But the more I got into it, the more I realised that actually the parents themselves never had proper food education in school. Cooking in schools became very different. It became about technology, less about cooking. And so I don't think that parents are really equipped to help children have a healthy diet because they don't have a healthy diet themselves. So my answer to this, I would like the state to take charge of lunchtime as a lesson. They do this in Finland. It's part of the curriculum to encourage and teach children to like a healthy diet. The idea of food and the development of food is laced into their learning.
And it seems Prue isn't alone with her thoughts on vegetarian food in schools. The Swan School in Oxford opened its doors in September. The food in its canteen is exclusively vegetarian and children are banned from bringing packed lunches.
A lot of it's new for me, so I find it very hard to eat courgettes. My favourite thing was today's meal, the corn sausages. My least favourite thing is the lentil lasagna.
Headteacher Kay Wood is clear that she feels they've made the right choice, but admits it hasn't all been plain sailing.
We did think very carefully before we made the policy decision. And really, firstly, there are benefits around the quality of the meals that we're able to provide. The second reason is around the environmental benefits of reducing our meat consumption. But perhaps the most important one was around ensuring that all of our students are able to eat together as one community. Everyone can eat a vegetarian meal together, and we were very keen to make sure that our canteen and our dining hall are really inclusive.
Why do you think it was that there were some parents who were just so vocal?
Yeah, I think that because we're a new school, people are always going to be vocal about anything that we do that's a little bit different. But I don't think that that should deter us from doing things that we think are really beneficial to the children.
It's a radical idea that some of the pupils and their parents approached with apprehension, but it seems many have been swayed by the quality of the food itself.
We all have the same food and it's tasty.
What did you think when you first heard that there wasn't going to be any meat on the menu?
It was different, but when you get used to it, it's fine and you're settled in with it.
You have a bit of a lack of choice, don't you? Because you've only got one thing every day. Do you think that's a problem?
I don't think it's a problem, but I think it could be something that could improve. I'm a really picky eater. I thought the food was going to be really bad because I don't really eat like vegetarian foods, but it was actually really nice. Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, not 100% convinced. Yeah. What makes you a bit hesitant?
I think we're like growing and we need to have like protein and energy.
But what about the impact on children's nutrition of restricting choice in this way? Frankie Phillips is a dietitian from the British Nutrition Foundation.
Some of the meals that are on the menu there seem absolutely fine. You know, they've got plenty of protein. They would have a significant amount of iron, although the iron we know from vegetable sources is not as well absorbed as the heme iron that we find in red meat. So the menu looks fine in principle. There is that concern that it's going to not be able to provide the omega-3 rich oily fish, which other menus in schools need to provide at least once every 3 weeks.
In general, it seems as though the move has gone down well with parents. Ingrid Graner and David Haycock's sons are both in Year 7.
One thing that's really interesting about that generation of kids, I think, is that they are really interested in the environment. And so if he's going to turn his nose up at corn, I don't think he can do that.
He's really liked it, actually. He's really enjoyed it. I mean, he admits that some of his friends haven't been so keen. They wish they had sort of more choice.
The move by the Swan School has come at a time where meat has never been more hotly debated. The NFU has raised concerns recently that initiatives like this risk demonising meat, something Kay Wood is adamant they are not doing.
I would say our approach is about reducing meat consumption and also encouraging higher standards of meat welfare. Unfortunately, on a school lunch budget, the quality of meat that you're able to provide would not meet those standards, which I'm sure that most of us at home would want to be maintaining.
So what does the future hold? With endorsements for meat-free canteens flowing in from Paul McCartney, Prue Leith and others, amidst a tide of global pledges to reduce meat consumption, more young people may find they need to adapt to vegetarian lunches.
Charlotte Baker reporting. I spoke to Sir Paul McCartney about a decade of his campaigning for meat-free Mondays.
When we started, we knew of three schools that did it. And we were so proud of them. We thought, wow, you know, it's so great. And I see now today that an estimated 3,500 to 5,000 schools are involved. So that is incredible. And a lot of them do credit our campaign for sort of making it possible. I think the thing was that we said to everyone, look, there's this idea that you could go meat-free on Monday. You don't have to. We're not pushing you. You don't have to go fully veggie or vegan or anything. But just try it for one day. And the idea was that if we don't preach and we don't push, people will do it and then think, oh, it's not so bad. And that's what's happened.
Who do you think's driving it? Is it the children or is it the schools that are taking it up, do you think?
I think it's both. What we started to do, realising that there were three, we started to feed them with material. We'd say, you know, the teachers, here's some nice pictures, here's some facts about the environment particularly, and you can use these in the class. And the teachers then responded and said, oh, this went down well. Have you got any more? And then we were very careful to ask the kids, you know, what do you think? Actually, one of my own kids' schools was one of the first ones because the chef at the school who did all the school dinners was this Liverpool guy who was really into the idea. And he you know, preached it. It was great. So I said to him, let me ask some of the kids, what do you think, you know? Oh, yeah, we love it. In fact, I think there was one day when there was something that wasn't exactly veggie and the kids pulled him up on it. So, you know, I think it was an interesting thing for them, and they certainly didn't mind it. That was what we were worried about, that they or the parents would seriously say, wait a minute, you can't do that. And we said, it's only one day, and it's just an idea, it's a change. Anyway, the kids ended up loving it, and the parents did too. And so suddenly you've got this crazy statistic of 3,500 plus.
Which is, of course, a far cry from when, I guess it would be Linda driving you back in the 70s to go vegetarian, when it was, I mean, it was completely, it was viewed so differently then.
Yeah, it really was. I would say there was, when we first came down to London from Liverpool, there was one restaurant called Cranks, which gives you the idea of how people thought of vegetarian. So, it's a massive change. Linda and I were on a farm and there were lambs gambling around in the field and we were eating leg of lamb. And we didn't make the connection. And we just suddenly went, oh, well, wait a minute. And the light bulb went off. And we said, should we try and do something about this? Which we did. And that started it. But that was a long time ago. And it was very difficult to do, but you know what? We took it as a fun challenge. We said, well, what are we going to do at Christmas? I said, I want to carve something. You know, I'm the dad in this family. I've got to carve something. Old traditionalist ideas. But so Linda ended up, she thought, you know what we could do? She made what we called a macaroni turkey. It was like a mac and cheese, but she let it set. So it went hard. Oh. And then the next day when it was sort of cold, you could actually just slice it.
So you had cold sliced macaroni cheese on Christmas?
No, it starts off cold and then you fry it, heat it up or something. But it looks like a little central. The thing always for us was to find something to put in the middle of the plate. Now you'd taken the meat out. We called it the hole in the middle of the plate. So that was always the thing. But we actually took it as a fun challenge.
So when was the last time you had meat?
Oh, I don't know, over 30 years ago. Someone just said to me it's 40. So it could be over 40 years ago. I don't know.
When you hear smell bacon sizzling, you're not tempted?
No, but I understand, because I did love the smell of bacon. And now, I mean, it's not that I don't like the smell of bacon. I just don't want to eat it for the various reasons. You know, it's like I love the smell of coffee in the morning, but I'm not a big coffee drinker. Some things just smell good. But no, I'm just not interested for a number of reasons. One was originally the animal welfare aspect that, you know, and it gets a bit, you get on your soapbox, so I'll try not to. But, you know, I say to people, we're on this planet, which appears to be the only one in the universe that is suitable for the way we live. And alongside of us, there's these little creatures. And I want to give them a shot at living. You know, so that's my attitude. I just don't want to kill one of them.
Of course, now you've got the climate activists on your side too, as well, yes. to some extent, anyway, as far as meat is concerned.
No, that's true. That's one of the very interesting things that kicked in. I think it was 2006 when the United Nations produced a report called Livestock's Long Shadow, which I was told about and I read. And it was fascinating, you know, that it said, no, this is a big contributor to greenhouse gases, the methane. Because until then, we'd assumed it was just transport. It was just cars, trucks, aeroplanes, everything. And so suddenly that gave a great boost to what we'd been thinking and saying. So now we then had this environmental aspect, which was like, you know, if you happen to go veggie, at least even if it's only one day a week, if enough of us do that, there will be an impact.
Okay, so tell us about Christmas then this year, because you were talking about, what, 30, 40 years ago when you're carving a mac and cheese.
Yeah.
Now what happens on the McCartney Christmas Day?
Oh, we're much more sophisticated now. Now, what it is we have a food company which produces a roast. So we actually have a veggie roast, and I am called upon, carve it. So I do, ceremoniously. And yeah, we actually have a roast. But the thing about it is you have all the other stuff. You have the roast potatoes, you have the, you know, all the veg and everything. And so in the middle of the plate now, there's no longer a hole. There's a roast, a veggie roast. And, you know, sometimes we have friends around who will try it. God, I love this. You know, so it's evolving, as we all are, as the planet is, our dietary tastes. Well, I mean, it's not just the veggie thing. There's so many things are evolving along with it. And I think it's just a great thing. I mean, when I was at school, the idea of doing gym was horrific. And, you know, you wouldn't catch me near a gym. Now I love it. I'm evolving.
Okay, so you've got you're all sitting around this, I don't even know what to call it, but your roast, your veggie roast.
Veggie roast.
And paint us the scene of the McCartney Christmas. Is there a big family gathering? Are you listening to music? Are you watching the Queen's speech?
Yeah, it's like that. It depends how many family we have around. The more the merrier. But it is a bunch of us. And I'm carving a roast, and with the rest of the stuff's all there.
Carols?
Brussels sprouts. No, actually, I was thinking, wondering whether to tell you about the music thing. Years ago, I thought, there's not very good Christmas records. There's a Phil Spector record I like, but I thought, I'd like just something kind of traditional and simple and easy with all the Good King Wenceslas and all of that. So I actually went into my studio over a couple of years. I made one, but it's just for the family. So I'm afraid Dad's Christmas Carol record comes on. Yeah, Silent Night. Now, it's
This is not something you've released.
This is nothing released. No, this is just for the family. That's why I was wondering whether to say anything about it or not. It is. It just gets brought out each year. I've just got a little demo of it. But, you know, the kids like it. But now it's kind of traditional. So it's something they've heard through the years, you know. And now it's the grandkids getting indoctrinated with my carols record. But it's fun. We have a few little things like that. And then there's the booze. And it's all very jolly.
Okay, so you are going to be playing next year at Glastonbury. Mm. This is, I mean, it's a big year, 50th anniversary year.
Yeah.
Which is why they said they didn't want anybody else really but you. Mm. Will you get nervous about that?
Well, you know, could be, because you can get nervous about any concert. But what I do if I've got something like that I consider a big thing is I'm doing 10 concerts before it, so to get up to speed. I mean, you know, you don't get an athlete just coming into the Olympics not having done a few races beforehand. So yeah, we've got some gigs in Europe that we're going to do, and those are kind of nice. So to get up to speed. So the idea is by the time I get to Glastonbury, it'll just be just like another gig. But of course it won't be, because it's very special. The thing I like about Glastonbury, actually, is all the sort of the ley lines and all the sort of all of that. Come on.
What do you mean?
I've got a friend who's very, yeah, man, he's into all that. So do you know it's on the ley lines? And then you do it's all cross and the intersect at Glastonbury. So I kind of like that. We're going
but
to be
what
on.
Is it, how does it affect you? I mean, what do you do? What's different about it being on the ley lines when you're there performing?
Well, it's magical. You get transformed into a magical being. Now, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's fun. It just adds to the fun, really, you know. But he's quite serious about it, and I like that. So I take a little bit of his seriousness and have a laugh with it. But you should research it. It's apparently very true.
You'll know that Coldplay have decided that they are not going to tour because of their concerns about the impact on climate change. And I wonder, when you're talking about touring in Europe, whether it's something, because you've long been a climate activist, whether it's something that you are aware of and think about how you can, affect your own touring carbon footprint.
Yeah, I mean, I am aware of it, and you do your best. But it is very difficult if you're going to tour. If I'm going to go and tour in America, you can't say, you can't even say we'll go by Greyhound bus, because that's just as bad. And we certainly can't just bike our way around, you know. So it's a reality. You just have to do it. And I think you just have to plant a lot of trees. You know, you just have to think, I'm going to do that, but I'll plant a lot of trees. So that's kind of how I offset it. Is doing things that will make up for it. But if I am going to tour, then that is going to involve travel, which is going to involve a carbon footprint. So you try and offset it. That's what I try and do.
Okay, so I wonder, so that idea, whether it's climate change or the vegetarianism in schools, are you acutely conscious that actually older people are being pushed into it by younger people? I mean, you accept it, of course, because we're accepting you've been sort of taking this position for years.
Yeah.
Are you feeling like this is great? I was in the wrong generation. This is the generation I was part of.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think it's fine. Young people always push old people into stuff. It's not just these issues, you know, because they're sensible. And it's their world that is about to happen, you know. And I think, you know, the whole school kids strike thing, you know, you'll get people saying, oh, they should have been at school this afternoon. It's like, yeah, but there's not going to be a school if nobody gets on to climate change. So I'm very pleased, actually, that young people, you know, are thinking this way. Hey, think about it. They could think the opposite way. They could be like, oh, no, let's Trump. Let's go crazy. It's a hoax. They could be saying that. Well, luckily they're not. They're way too sensible. So I like that they're pushing older people into things.
You paint this scene of the McCartney family with listening to your carols or your songs. I don't know the carols. Mm. What's the ideal?
And they're not my songs. It's just traditional carols
that you sing.
Done a little bit.
So you're listening to them.
I don't even sing them. They're instrumentals.
Really?
Yeah. It's just me going.
Why plunk, wouldn't plunk, you plunk, sing?
Plunk, plunk, plunk. Well, because I like doing instrumentals better. It's easier.
And what are you hoping for Christmas? What's the ideal Christmas present?
For Christmas, I don't know, peace on earth and goodwill. No. What am I looking for Christmas? I don't know, actually. I'm terrible on presents. I just gratefully accept whatever I get.
Well, happy Christmas.
Thank you, and to you and all your listeners.
Sir Paul McCartney there. Well, there's one older person who is not so happy about being pushed into climate criticism, shall we say, by a younger campaigner. And that's President Trump, because you may well know that Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old climate campaigner behind the school strikes that we were hearing about there, she's been widely congratulated since we were told yesterday by Time magazine that she is their person of the year. Rather different line, though, taken by President Trump. He has tweeted, "So ridiculous. Greta must work on her anger management problem, then go to a good old-fashioned movie with a friend. Chill, Greta, chill." Meanwhile, we are expecting the first formal vote on the impeachment of President Trump later today. First time there's been a vote on the formal charges accusing him of abuse of power. If, as seems inevitable, they are approved by the Judiciary Committee, then the full US House of Representatives will vote on impeaching the president in the coming days. It's a moment of genuine history for America. Our Washington correspondent Chris Buckley has been looking to the experiences of Bill Clinton and the Founding Fathers to see what's likely to happen next in this dramatic constitutional clash.
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
The Broadway musical that bears his name tells the story of Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers of the United States who promoted the idea of a written constitution for the country.
Let us begin where our founders began, in 1776.
When the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, called for articles of impeachment to be drafted against President Trump, she gave the historic moment some historical context.
When crafting the Constitution, the founders feared the return of a monarchy in America. They specifically feared the prospect of a king president corrupted by foreign influence. They therefore created a constitutional remedy, impeachment.
My client needs a strong defense. You're the solution.
Who's your client?
The new U.S. Constitution?
This is expected to be only the third time that a U.S. president has been impeached. But the American public don't have to look down the centuries to get some idea of what's likely to happen next.
As the Constitution dictates, they came to tell the Senate they had accused the president of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Just over two decades ago, Bill Clinton found himself on trial in the Senate, accused of perjury and obstructing justice by lying about his relationship with a White House intern, Monica Lewinsky.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Jonathan Turley, who's a law professor at George Washington University, was called as a legal expert when Bill Clinton was impeached, and again during the recent inquiry into whether Donald Trump should face trial.
In the Clinton hearing of experts, we had a lot of substantive discussion as to what this impeachment standard is. In the hearing on this impeachment, we were really seeing members talk past each other. And then when I got home, my emails and my phones were packed with threats and rage.
This Congress does not speak for me.
Let it be.
They're playing a dangerous game.
Alexander Hamilton and the other founding fathers may have prepared for this kind of constitutional battle, but their suggested solution has split an already divided country.
Are you talking about the witch hunt? Is that what you mean?
President Trump has furiously denied the central allegation that he suspended military aid to Ukraine to try to force the country into launching investigations into his political rivals.
Now they say, give us anything, we'll impeach him. Let him go to the refrigerator and pick an orange. We're going to impeach him.
His open and regularly tweeted fury is in stark contrast to the strategy adopted by the last sitting president to face trial.
If you go back and look, I wouldn't say anything about it.
In a recent interview, Bill Clinton may have had a warning for his fellow Democrats who are pursuing impeachment. It can backfire.
I knew it wouldn't succeed. And we won the 98 elections, which was a referendum on impeachment. It'd been since 1822. That a president's party won seats in the House of Representatives in the sixth year of a presidency. And they outspent us $100 million, which was serious money then.
And you think that was a reaction, people saying...
Oh, I know it was.
It is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said William Jefferson Clinton be and he hereby is acquitted of the charges in the said articles.
The outcome of Donald Trump's looming trial looks just as predictable as it was in the case of Bill Clinton. The House of Representatives has a Democratic majority, which means it's highly likely Mr. Trump will be impeached. But in the trial in the upper house of Congress, the 100 senators act as jurors, and the president's Republican Party control the Senate. There seems absolutely no chance that they would convict the president. Democrats say purely on the grounds of political principle, they need to take a shot at removing the president. But Professor Jonathan Turley says the prospect of a nasty Senate trial right at the start of an election year in America is a big risk for both parties.
The impeachment of Donald Trump is going to be a live torpedo in the water, and nobody knows where it's going to hit. But it'll hit, and it's going to cause damage under the waterline for one party or the other.
The end of Alexander Hamilton's story may carry a warning for all those involved in this impeachment drama. He died after losing a duel.
I am not throwing away my shot!
Chris Buckler reporting, while Peter Baker is the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times and co-author of Impeachment and American History. Francis Steed Sellers is senior writer at the Washington Post, and both join me. Peter Baker, this impeachment process has been going on for some time. How big a moment, though, is today in American political history?
Well, it's a pretty big day. The House Judiciary Committee is likely to vote on two articles of impeachment against President Trump, charging him with abuse of office, abuse of power, and obstruction of Congress. We've only had two other presidents in American history who were actually ever impeached. This is setting them on the path to a full House vote by next week, which would make President Trump the third.
Okay, and how does this impeachment compare with the previous ones?
Well, it's alike and dissimilar in so many different ways. One of the ways it's alike, of course, is it has generated a lot of partisan anger and frustration and division, much like the Clinton impeachment. It looks like this House vote next week will ultimately, as well as the committee vote today, will be along party lines. That means there's no consensus in society. And that means that it's likely to have an acquittal if it goes to a Senate trial, because you have to have a two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict. There aren't enough Democrats to do that.
And Francis Steed Sellers, I mean, the interesting thing is because that seems to be the expectation so broadly, one wonders what will be achieved and who will be holed beneath the waterline, to you know, pick up on a phrase in Chris Buckler's report.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues that came out last night was in this, you know, mammoth 3.5-hour hearing. Gerald Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, tried to open by suggesting, by elevating the conversation, asking people how they want to be remembered. Does the evidence support the case that Trump pressured Ukraine? Does this amount to high crimes and misdemeanors? What are the implications for national security and democratic integrity and for the public good? And then after that, we went through 3.5 hours of very divided and partisan discussion, as Peter says, setting up the moment today when lawmakers will continue what's called as markup. This is the process of hashing out the legislative action they'll take to the floor. And they will have the possibility of bringing forth amendments. And again, one imagines that they'll be Republican amendments and will be shot down by the Democrats.
So one wonders how much difference, whether the evidence really makes that much difference, Peter Baker.
Well, we're sort of in this moment right now where everybody lives in their own fact world. Everybody sees the same elephant, but is touching different parts of it, right? And I think that they're coming away with it with different realities. To listen to these hearings that we've had in the Judiciary Committee and before in the Intelligence Committee over the last few weeks is to hear very starkly different views of the facts. You know, the argument is that basically the problem for the Republicans here is, unlike the Democrats in 1998 with President Clinton, is that their president is not acknowledging any wrongdoing, and therefore it's harder for them to make the case, well, he did wrong, but it's not impeachable. That's what they did in 1998, because President Clinton, after initially lying to the country, eventually did admit that he had done something wrong. So the Democrats could say, well, he did wrong, but we don't think it's impeachable. So the Republicans are stuck in a position of trying to argue things that seem against the facts to begin with, that he didn't pressure Ukraine, that he only cared about the United States, not his own personal political interests. Those seem belied by the testimony we've heard.
Okay, so that's their lines of defense, Francis Steed Sellers. Are they struggling with that then, the Republicans?
Well, the Republicans are sort of trying to push this off at this moment to the Senate, the Republican-dominated Senate, where it would take 20 Republicans to move over to the Democratic side to convict the president, which is highly unlikely to happen. So in a way, we're sort of going through a pro forma process in that sense. One of the things that came up from the Republicans yesterday was a sense that the process was unfair. It's moving too hastily. And also they leveled the threat against Democrats. You know, see you in 2020, you'll lose your majority. I've been out recently out west, and I've heard Democratic voters saying, again, referring to 2020, they're not worried. Maybe Trump will be voted out. So here are two different sides of people talking about what might happen in 2020. And both, I think, miss the point that the Constitution is intended to avoid majority rule and look at bigger issues, to talk about the res publica, the republic. They were classically educated founders who came up with this constitution and were definitely thinking about the common good and not majority rule.
Okay, so Peter Baker, who do you think ultimately is being more harmed by this process?
Well, we won't know for 11 months, obviously. I mean, it's a big gamble on the part of the Democrats. Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, had once said she didn't want to go forward with any kind of impeachment unless there was substantial chance of it being bipartisan. That's not happening here. There's no bipartisan impeachment here. So she did that because she said that originally because she knew it could, in theory, backlash against the Democrats, at least some of the Democrats at the polls next year. The Democrats went ahead and decided to do that anyway. The Republicans, as Francis was just saying, feel confident that they can turn this around to an electoral advantage. The president will certainly take an acquittal from the Senate and say, look, I was exonerated. Look at this witch hunt that the Democrats put the country through. And that will be the argument in 2020. That's the real final verdict.
Peter Baker, Francis Steed Sellers, thank you both very much. More than 200 starlings have been found dead in a lane in Anglesey in North Wales. They'll be tested to try to discover how they died. One local person said it was as if they had dropped down dead from the sky. PC Dewi Evans is from North Wales Police and I asked him how the investigation was going.
The circumstances are pretty much out of the ordinary, I think that's fair to say. When I went to the scene, I found approximately 225 dead starling on the road surface itself. I would estimate that in the hedges on either side of the road, there were something in the region of tens of dead starling. And then in the fields on either side of the road, there were zero dead starling, which was very strange. So we are investigating, and the latest is we've recovered some birds as samples, or I should say staff from the Animal and Plant Health Agency have. So they'll be looking out to do toxicology tests and a post-mortem on the specimens to try and establish exactly what went on. We're keeping an open mind at the moment. So we're doing the toxicology tests in case, and we're doing post-mortem tests to see whether that identifies the cause of death. We have actually been developing an explanation for what's happened. It's a rational explanation, but we're not going to be revealing what we think the explanation is until such time as the investigation's complete.
So you have a theory, but why are you loath to tell us what it is?
It's a live investigation at the moment, and our job as the police is to keep an open mind, not to jump to conclusions, to look at things logically, and when we've gathered all the evidence, it's at that point that we'll reveal what we think has happened.
Okay. People know starlings for the beautiful murmurations where you see clouds of them moving together. And I know that you sort of put a call out online and on social media for anybody who might have information to help in this investigation. Did you get much back?
Yes, people have been wonderful. We've had we've had all sorts of weird and wonderful theories, but we've also had some very good theories back as well. It's interesting because when you do research on this phenomenon, if you want to call it that, it seems to have happened on many occasions in the past. If you Google it, for example, similar things have happened in Italy, in Canada, Somerset, New York. But what's particularly strange, if you will, about this case is that it seems that this exact phenomenon happened in the same spot about 12 years ago.
How extraordinary.
It is very strange.
So did you have witnesses to this?
Again, it's a developing investigation. So, it's a only been, like you mentioned, 24, 48 hours since it happened. So we're still developing our leads at the moment.
Any suspects?
Well, we don't know yet whether there's criminality involved. So there may not be any suspects at all, in the sense that no crime's been committed. We haven't come to our conclusions yet.
PC Davy Evans talking to me just before we came on air. We're back at midday tomorrow. I'll be on air with Mark Mardell for 2 hours until 2 o'clock, assessing the new political landscape that we will inhabit by then. For the moment, that's the world at 1:45. You can find more podcasts of documentaries and current affairs at bbc.co.uk/radio4.